A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast. Welcome to the Invisible Gift podcast. I'm Andrew Kitley, your host, and I'm here today with James, the captain at One Fine Play. James, why are you joining me today?
Hi, Andrew. It's been 8 weeks that I've been sharing this space with you to talk about your latest podcast interview.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're really getting into the swing of it now.
I think we are. I quite like you in this little space as well, James, I'm not going to lie.
Well, we've spent many an hour in this room. We are in a podcasting studio in Northwest London. It's a small box that means that sound doesn't move around much. We recorded all of the sound bites we needed for season one of the show, which let's say was an emotional journey.
That's one word for it.
And now we've been coming back here every week for season two in this more relaxed format that seems to be going well.
Yes, seems to be getting good feedback.
You and I are bonding. And it seems to be doing the job.
Yeah. And for anyone that's never recorded a podcast in a studio, let me reassure you, the silence is eerie. it's a weird experience.
Isn't it amazing what happens when someone puts a microphone in front of you? How difficult it suddenly becomes to say normal sentences.
Yeah, because you think you're having a conversation and really you're not. And then, yeah, it's been hard.
Especially for you, you've got the headphones on. You're hearing yourself crystal clear quality back in your head all the time.
Yeah, and actually, it's made me start liking my voice, something that I never thought I'd have before. I've got that kind of South London deep voice. I like it.
Wow. You still won't watch yourself, though, will you?
No, screw that.
Amazing. Amazing. So, last week on the Invisible Gift podcast, you chatted to Michelle Catterson, the executive head teacher for the specialist dyslexic school Moon Hall in Reigate.
Yes, we did, and we got some great feedback on that. It was a really good show.
She's just so credible and doing such amazing groundbreaking work in the space.
Yeah, and I think she's an inspiration for a lot of other schools going out there, and she's just so hardworking, and that's really, she's a fighter for what she wants in the education system.
If you haven't listened to that episode, it's available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Go check it out. One thing before we kick off this week's episode, it would mean the world to us if you could share the name of this podcast with anyone you think it might bring value to. So someone with dyslexia, someone who has a family member with dyslexia, someone who maybe employs someone with dyslexia. We would love it if you could share the podcast with them. That would mean more to us than anything else you could do to support the show.
Yeah, and also just remember that 1 in 10 people have dyslexia. So I guarantee you know lots of people that really benefit from the show. And the feedback I've had from everyone saying how great and inspirational it's been has been amazing. So yeah, share away, guys. It really means the world to us.
Within her role at the BBC, Carrie has a strong focus on bringing greater diversity in all forms to broadcasting, including cognitive diversity.
She is a wealth of experience in the industry, and I've got to admit, I was very scared of meeting her, but what an amazing person. She completely made me feel at home. And as I said before you on the last podcast, I'm a bit of a hugger, and she hugged me, so she won straight away.
You guys talk about the challenges she experienced trying to get her son support. And you also speak about the lack of diversity and representation of neurodiversity in Parliament.
Yeah, so we spoke a lot about, because Kerry has done so much about this, and her son was a big passion, obviously, being a son, passionate. And she wanted to talk about her struggles, because what we don't say, again, my inexperience of not having children at the moment means that I don't really understand that point of view. And her experiences with that was something that could be shared by a lot of the listeners as well, James. And she really, really pushed that agenda through.
I'm looking forward to hearing about that. And another thing that I'm looking forward to hearing about, which hasn't been spoken about as far as I'm aware so far in the whole of the podcast, is the high dyslexic prison population.
Yeah, so ironically, Kerry is the first person we spoke to about this, and ironically, it came up quite a lot. So I believe there was a report issued around the same sort of time that this come about, but it's a really interesting take on a current situation that we have in the world, which is you guys need to take a listen to, because, again, I'm not going to do it any favours here.
First off, though, being a man of organisation and process, as many dyslexics are, you start with the same question that you always start with. Harry, how did you learn you were dyslexic? Let's get into it.
Let's take a listen. So, dyslexia, when did you, or have you, I assume, found out you're dyslexic?
It's a really good question. Because when I was a kid and at school, the D word just didn't exist. And so I never was diagnosed as such, not at primary school, secondary school, not at university. But it was really obvious that I had a big problem with writing and with spelling. Reading was actually curiously never so much of a problem for me. And also things like, you know, retrieval, word processing, organizing my thoughts. And I was just made to feel, particularly at primary school, which was, I think, when it was the, there was a real pinch point there. Which was kind of very sort of felt like a moral judgment. Like you're really lazy, you're feckless. It's almost like you're doing it on purpose, you know. And I'm made to feel that you were really stupid.
So would you say that, because for me, I kind of half felt that myself rather than external factors. Do you think that was a more of an internal thing or an external thing, like the school? Because I have very mixed opinions from people I speak to. A lot of people say it's definitely the school. You know, I didn't feel anything until they told me I'm never going to make anything of myself. But some people are like, it's just me. I was very harsh on myself.
I think I was quite harsh on myself. I think I used to feel that there was kind of like a woolly cat in my head, and I knew what I wanted to say, or with a word, how it was spelled, I could kind of almost see it. But then there was something that just wasn't connecting, getting through. And, you know, I kind of had this sense that I wasn't stupid. On some level, I kind of knew I was perfectly intelligent. And, you know, I think, I mean, my mum used to say, oh, you know, you're a late developer, which was a bit of a mixed blessing, because that was a kind of felt like a kind of, well, that's a nice way of saying you're a bit dim. on the other hand, she always used to say, oh, you know, when you were 1.5, you could recite the whole of Beatrix Potter book and things like this, which used to make me feel, well, I can't be that stupid if I could do that. So she was quite good in that. But then I had a teacher who was infamous in my primary school, and we used to have spelling tests. And then also we'd have all the timetables going around the room with your name on it and stars as to, you know, when you could learn those tables or do those spellings. And, you know, we used to have to stand up and spell words. And, of course, the stress of it all was so terrible. And I don't think I ever got over it, to be honest with you. And I remember the night before these spelling tests, they would give you, say, 6 spellings to learn, that I would, I'd sit there writing the words with my finger on my forehead, because I sort of dreamt that somehow or other then it would go in and I'd remember it.
I think you're trying to visualize it, which is what most dyslexic people learn in visualization, kind of visualization or kinesthetic. But I think a lot of teachers, and I used to teach martial arts, so I kind of sympathize with this. Sometimes when what you would perceive as a weaker student, you'd kind of work on them harder because you feel like if you push them more, they would come out the other end. And do you know what? In karate, nearly all the time, that was actually the case. They normally, if I kind of pushed them harder, they would come out. But it's not a memory test, whereas a lot of the things we'd done at school was more memory tests. I mean, who really wins at school? People with great memories, right?
And people... I've not got a bad memory, but it's under in stressful situations, like being a kid and told to stand up in front of a class, do something that you find very difficult with an audience. You know, that certainly affects my retrieval, and it affects it to this day. I mean, I've been in job interviews where I've struggled to remember something, or I've said the wrong word, I've struggled to remember somebody's name. And, you know, it still happens to me today. And I've actually, at one point, I remember going to a production company and they said, well, name your top 10 talent. This is when I'd moved from production into talent management. And I went completely blank.
Yeah.
So I actually went back to see them. They asked me to come in and see them again about a year later.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I took a little book with me where I'd written everybody down. I thought, can I do this? You know, I thought, a nice little moleskin book, went in there with that. I thought, could I actually do this? I thought, well, what's the alternative? I'm going to sit there and not say anything.
Yeah.
So they said, you know, again, you know, who'd you rate? Took my little book out and just started looking at the names. No one said anything.
No.
No one said anything. And I had my little prompt. I thought, well, and so much of it is confidence to actually just come up with a little solution or even be honest.
Well, I suppose it's comfort in what you're doing. I always found it funny that if someone asked me to stand up and spell something or do sums, I'd freeze. And I mean, there was nothing coming out my mouth, let alone even attempting it. I just go, duh, really shocked. And that also happened in exams. But if you asked me in a drama class to stand up and do a monologue, I would, because it hadn't been pre-planned, as long as it was spur of the moment, I felt comfortable in doing that. But as soon as you gave me anything predetermined, I was like, oh, I can't do it. And you're right about stress. I used to cry. I used to stand there in the frustration. And it's funny because when on the first season, I spoke about crying. And everybody knows that time when you cry out of pure frustration. It's not crying. I'm not emotional. I'm angry. And I just want to throw things. And it's interesting because when... at the end of season one, I had to do the sound bites that get put in after. And James, the producer, will tell you that it was hard. I mean, the season itself, doing this, is amazing. But the script of reading out about every single person was so hard. It doesn't matter what age you get. It puts you straight back to where you were when you were younger.
I think that low self-esteem, it just jumps out at you and it just gets you. And I know sometimes I can feel quite defensive and I have to try and sort of, you know, take a step back from that, because I know it's just a knee-jerk reaction from that wall that shoots straight back to the past and when things were really challenging and difficult.
I find it just so strange that you can be literally back there. Sometimes, obviously, I'm a visual thinker. I can actually see the class around me when someone's asking something really hard.
Completely. I mean, I can see it now. I can see literally the room. I can see the tables. I can see the kids. I can see the teacher, unfortunately. I can see, you know, all those charts. Yeah. I mean, you know, well, a lot of it was, when I was at school, was sort of you learnt by rote. You know, you learnt, and I still... even the alphabet, if I'm really honest, the alphabet, I have to run through it.
Yeah.
And all tables. Okay, this is a terrible admission. I actually even use my fingers for counting.
So do I.
It's like, and people sometimes, I realise I'm doing it, people are kind of looking at me going like, what is she doing? You know?
Do you find you've kind of gone, screw it, this is who I am. You either like it or lump it. Because you're probably at a stage in your career now where you're kind of like, you know what, this is the way I do things and I'm not going to change for anyone. Because that's kind of how I've got now. Is that sort of how you are?
Absolutely. But I have to say, really recently, to be honest, and that's because I think there's been such a sea change in the world about people being authentic and people wanting to be recognised for who they really are. Yeah. And I've put, you know, Black Lives Matters into that as well.
Mm.
I think there's a much more awareness of difference and there's a valuing of difference now. And also because I'm in a, you know, very fortunate position because, you know, I've got an established career. Mm. If I was starting out now, I'd think twice about self-declaring that I was dyslexic because, you know, you're up against people who aren't and there's a lot of still lack of understanding, you know, about it or about any kind of neurodisability. So people aren't really sure. So it's sort of, it's such a competitive world in television. It's really, you have to be very resilient.
Mm.
And, you know, do you want to give somebody ammunition that is going to possibly disadvantage you compared to someone else that they might want to hire? But, you know, because I'm in a very established position now, I've just come out and said it, but this is the first time in the job that I do now at BBC Studios where I've self-declared and I just have said it now. And it's amazing. It's like a revelation. And in the past, I had all sorts of tactics. I mean, I was running Who Do You Think You Are, for example.
Mm.
So this was a series with, you know, millions of pounds budget. We were sending celebrities all over the world and we had very complicated schedules and the production manager would print them out on A4. So it was tiny little columns, tiny little lines, tiny little things. And I almost feel physically sick when I saw these things. I'd sit in these big meetings going line by line through the budget or whatever. I'd be thinking, it's all swimming before my eyes. And so I said, she was very nice. And I said to her, could you print these out like A3?
Yeah.
And can we have a bit of a colour in these columns? And she sort of looked at me a bit strangely. And I said, I just find it easier to work with like this. It was just because I was a boss. It was like, well, okay, we'll do what Carrie says. But I still didn't say why.
So you know what? That's beautiful because it's one of those things where people would assume, and this is where lack of understanding comes in. People would assume that you're just being awkward. That is what they would assume. When in truth, it's a much bigger and broader issue. And that's why I love the producer guys at One Fine Play who listen. Because every time I do something, they said, is that format all right for you? Or can we do something else? Can we send you a recording? Can we put in bullet points? Is there anything that help you? Because obviously they sit here and hear me. But how many people have to say something like that and just being thought of as being quite an arse? When actually what you're doing is just trying to help everything out by doing that.
I think the difference now, and I hope it's the same for you, is that now I will say, I'm dyslexic, this is what I need. Whereas before I'd just say, this is what I need, and people would do it, but it was a sort of bit mysterious. But I mean, going back to your original question about when did you know you dyslexic, it was sort of like, I think probably by the time I got to university that the dyslexia word was possibly flying around.
Mm.
But I've never had a personal formal diagnosis. I've never had personal testing.
Mm.
But my son is profoundly dyslexic and dyspraxic to the extent that, you know, he had to scribe his exams, for example, because he can't really write.
Yeah.
Or it's illegible what he writes.
Yeah.
So we went on this sort of journey to try and find out what was going on with him.
Mm.
And so, of course, he had lots of testing and he had Ed Sight tests and he had specialist, you know, dyslexia, dyspraxia tests and so on. So, of course, I was always sitting there with him and I was thinking, oh, yeah, I just thought exactly the same as him. Yeah. And so in some ways, someone asked me the other day, are you tempted to actually get a formal test? In a way I am, perhaps. But having been through all of that with him, I pretty much know.
Yeah. From working a lot with your son and your experience at school, did you notice any big differences or movements along?
Well, enormously, in the sense that, you know, it's a acknowledged learning difficulty, dyslexia, which it wasn't, you know, nobody talked about it. Nobody understood any sort of idea that when I was at primary school, that it might be something, you know, that was a problem in terms of how you're learning. So that was the big difference. But getting him into specialist education was a complete nightmare. Mm. And, you know, he was in a primary school with 450 kids, with a special needs teacher who was there for 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And so he would be taken out with a little group for reading and things. But cognitively, he's always been extremely able.
Mm.
And they then came back and said, well, he's probably not in an appropriate group because he's actually very able, because some of these kids had other issues. So essentially, then it was, how do we get the funding to get him into some kind of specialist education? And the school were very unhelpful with it, actually. Mm. They, in fact, the head teacher just said to us twice, don't even go there. He said, don't even try. You will never get any funding, not from this borough. You won't get any.
And I hear that. I hear that a lot from a lot of parents.
Do you?
Yeah. So my family members had exactly the same sort of situation. I think the thing is, with so many, with it growing so much, with awareness becomes more people know they've got it and more people getting tested, so it's happening a lot earlier. And I just think these days it's a big step to try and fill, and I don't think anyone knows where to start, really.
I mean, it became a bit of a battle, and I think often people with dyslexia, we've had a lot of pushback, we've had a lot of struggles, and we've had to find ways round things.
Yeah.
And, you know, I became a pretty effective advocate for my son.
Yeah.
And and at the time, it's all about money. At the time, there was a brilliant parent group in our area who we were put in touch with when I applied for him for what was then a statement, which is now an education, health and care plan. And they supported me. They sent someone to come with us to the school.
Oh, wow.
And she just said, we're applying for this. You know, she pushed back to the head and said, we're applying for this. This is going to happen. Mm. You know, sort of get over it, get used to it. Yeah. She sat down in our kitchen and helped me write the application. And that's all been cut now. You know, hardly exist. They can't answer phones. They can't leave the office. They don't have the funding to do it. And I have I'm quite passionate about this, which is, I absolutely get the whole, integration, the idea of integrating kids with all sorts of different educational needs and learning challenges within mainstream school. And my son particularly wanted to go to a mainstream school. He didn't like the idea of going to just a special school.
Hmm.
But what you then have is teachers who are not trained
to do that.
And they've got 30 other kids that they have to look after. You can't expect them to know what to do.
Hmm.
And, you know, an intervention, even if it's only for, say, a couple of years, which is initially what happened with my son, was that he went to a special school primarily for dyslexia, where they took him out for 2 years. But in fact, his challenges were quite profound. So he then went on to another special school. But then he went back into mainstream for sixth form, and they had just had a really good unit in the sixth form college, local sixth form college, that supported him. But now, with personal budgets, it's all about money, and central government's going, you know, we'll just give you a personal budget, which is maybe £6,000 or £7,000. I mean, the education that our son got cost way, way more than that, because it was a full-time specialist education.
But don't you think that's the problem in not having diversity in Parliament? Because if 1 in 10 people are dyslexic, the chances of many dyslexic people, well, there isn't that many. There are dyslexic people within Parliament, but not many. Because in order, most people who get into government work or Parliament come from, do very well at school, do very well at university, and then get into government. So if you took a group of people, 100 people, and only 10 people in that 100 people are dyslexic, then because they don't understand what's going on, they don't prioritise it. And that's the very essence of having diversity in all forms in every organisation in the world, right? So how can you appreciate something if it's not there?
You're totally right. And I think it's, again, if you look at funding and you look at money differently, people in government and people in positions of power, all they have to do is to look, for example, at the prison population, 60% of whom have dyslexia or some kind of neurodisability, and go, how much is it costing to keep someone in a youth detention centre? How much is it costing to keep someone in prison? What other things happen around people like that? Alcoholism, depression, mental health issues, obviously crime, because that's why they're there in the first place. But all those factors have been in play. The money that you spend early on for intervention with a kid who's at school is nothing, is peanuts compared to that. So, you know, I think a lot of youngsters, you know, if they don't get that support, I'm not saying that they will go on and end up in that situation, but they've got so many pressures on them that there's a higher chance that they might.
The first thing I become when I was at school was a bad student. I become naughty. I disrupted classes. I wasn't in lots of fights, but we still fought a lot. And if it wasn't for my parents, I could have gone down a very different route. In fact, there is actually a key point in my life where I didn't go down another route. And my parents already thought I did, because when I left school, I became a scaffolder, which the people I worked with when I was a scaffolder, and I can say the amount of dyslexia amongst them is unbelievable. The first course I went on as a scaffolder, I was the only one in the class that could read and write.
Wow.
We had Eastern European students in there who could read and write better than the other scaffolders. So
wow.
I remember sitting in that class going, how lucky am I? Like, I thought I was bad. I thought I was really bad. And when I saw that, I was like, holy crap. And the reputation scaffolders have still got now, I mean, it's come on construction generally, it's come on leaps and bounds. But there was a defining point in my life where I could have gone another way. And it was my parents. But if both my parents were dyslexic and struggled at school and went through the same thing I was going through and chose the wrong path in life, then it's just an endless cycle. Mm. So we can sit here in this conversation. I've had this conversation with people. We could sit here and blame, you know, you could say, yes, it was education, but, you know, they made wrong choices in life. But how can you make different choices if it's hereditary, the people before you had the same struggles? And once you get in that cycle, anyone that's ever struggled knows the cycle, once you're in it, it's impossible to get out of. Sorry, hard to get out of, not impossible. But
not impossible, but you're right. I mean, and when you look at, and you know, it does run in families. You know, for me, it's on both sides of my family. You know, with my son, it's on both sides. You know, it's on my husband's side, it's on my side. So it's something that you're born with. It's not something that you acquire.
Yeah.
But I do think it has a profound effect. And you know, I wasn't naughty so much at school with the old time, but not perhaps as naughty as you were.
Mm.
But certainly at secondary school, I just bunked off. You know, I would start, you know, just not turning up because I just wanted to sort of get away, really. And I also think I got quite depressed.
Mm.
I mean, one of the things in a way was good because I just remember I actually went into a grammar school
yeah.
because what happened was that we moved to London and so I hadn't taken my 11 plus. So they sent me to a borough psychologist and out of that, because it was all just verbal, it was easy.
Yeah.
We just had a chat.
Yeah.
And so based on that chat, they said, oh, she's grammar school material. I'd never have passed my 11 plus in a million years. Never.
Wow.
And so they sent me to a grammar school. There were three streams and I went in the middle stream.
Hmm.
And it was, in some ways, it was a good education, but it was not very creative. It was quite sort of reductive education and quite boring for most of it. But I remember you had to sit in the class and sort of zone out. And I think about maybe a book I was reading or some story, because obviously storytelling's actually at the heart of my whole career, making films and telling stories and getting people's stories, getting people to tell their stories.
Yeah.
And I used to just, I would, in my head, I would just see almost, I would run like a film almost. I would just see, and I'd rerun it and change it. And of course, eventually, that's what I end up doing as a job.
So let's jump in and talk about that. I mean, what was really important for me is Carrie was very late to discovering she had dyslexia, as you just heard. And the thing is, there's a lot of things you do when you're at school, when you're dyslexic, like zoning out, like she said, is what I used to do. I could sit there in a class for 40 minutes and not hear anything that was said in the class. And I'll be staring outside at birds singing, tweeting away and doing stuff like that. Or I remember one class I saw a guy sweeping up and I just watched him and it was half an hour class gone like that. I was just daydreaming. And then at the time you don't think it's anything. You just think you just don't care about the subject or something like that. But in fact, it's just the way our brains work. And Carrie, because she found out so late, that was a really great way of looking at it. She just thought she was different.
It's so funny talking about these things and hearing them now, because speaking on behalf of the non-dyslexics at school, you just had no awareness of that kind of thing. I just thought, I don't think we thought anything.
Well, when I used to speak to my friends and they used to go, oh, do you remember when Sir said that? I'd be like, they didn't say that. There's no way that come out of their mouth. And the problem is you're so in a different world that you're not in them surroundings, you're out of them, kind of like these earphones.
I think another interesting thing is the different meanings of the same words. So I'd have told you that I probably daydreamed, but I think had totally different experiences.
Yeah, but then again, in most things, there's two extremes. Me and you have actually discussed this before, not on the podcast. There's at one end, you've got the dyslexic people who daydream and struggle at school. But at the other end, you've got the high achievers that also daydream and struggle at school because it's their...
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodation, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
It's easy for them and it becomes boring.
So in your conversation with Carrie, you also spoke about how she became a cab driver to supplement her income and time to create and research her films.
Yeah, I mean, how do you even deal with that? That's like next level entrepreneurship. Now I know we hate that word, James, but it's like that's like solving a problem. You have something to solve, and you just go about doing it no matter what way you can.
It's that logical thinking thing that comes back that is kind of a natural born talent of dyslexics, it seems.
Well, I think the thing is, you think it comes back to failing again. And I know if you guys listen to season one, we talk a lot about failure, more than we do in season two, because we've kind of covered that area. But if you fail so much, then when you come up against a failure when you're older, you're not like, oh, I can't do this. You don't get frustrated. You just instantly find the solution. And because our minds are mapped completely different from non-neurodiverse people, we find different results there. And that's not to say that non-neurodiverse people don't get a job to solve their problem, but it's just that we don't see it as an obstacle. We just go around it.
Let's not say any more. Let's just get back into the conversation.
From what we've discussed and now to where you are, there's like a huge gap. So how did you get into the sort of position you are now? How did you go from struggling at school into, first of all, entering your industry? Because I can imagine it being very hard to get into.
I wanted to go into telly from when I was in my 20s, and I used to apply for things like the BBC training scheme, of course, never got anywhere. Mm. I went to university. Mm. I did okay at university, and I even ended up going into education, you know, as an English teacher.
Oh, wow.
Which is a bit ironic.
Well, you know, I got good at maths in the end, so I kind of, I get that.
In some respects. You know, and I did occasionally get picked up by my students, like, you spelt that wrong, you know, on the whiteboard or whatever. And I go, oh, yes, you know, just checking.
I think that's amazing. You've gone from not wanting to stand up in the class to actually being at the front writing stuff. That's unreal.
Yeah. I mean, I did used to practice. I used to usually practice if I had to write anything, if I couldn't use slides and I did need to scribble something, I would usually have looked at it beforehand. But, you know, being dyslexic, there's always going to be a moment when you can't see it. Mm. So I used to have my little sort of, just keeping you on your toes. Yeah, you know, well done for spotting that, you know, these little ruses. But, and then I wanted so much to go into TV. And I tried to find a part-time course so I could continue working, and I couldn't. And in the end, I found a year's course at Goldsmiths, which was like a TV MA.
Hmm.
And I managed to work part-time. I was lecturing by then in a polytechnic in English and film. And so I just kept that going. And then I went to college for a year. And then I just got a job off the back of college. So I actually went. You know, nowadays you have to be a runner and you have to start at a much lower level. I actually just leapfrogged straight into it as a researcher. And then within 2 years, I was directing.
Wow.
Which is pretty, even then, was pretty fast.
Where did you, I always find that the younger part of me had a lot of failures. And now I've kind of, I just try anything. Is that something that you feel happened to you? What gave you that confidence to do that? Because that's pretty confident, right? I'm just going to go do that.
I think, for me, it's always been once I absolutely feel it and I know I want to do it, there's nothing's going to stop me doing it. And I was just determined to do it. And it was just, I was sort of on a roll to do it. And I made a couple of films as part of my course, and that was very helpful. But also a friend of my brother's was working at the Museum of London, and they had an exhibition about the face, which was sponsored by Boots or something like that. And he said, I'd love to do a little film. So I went and did that. And so I just thought, well, I can do this. I know I can do it.
Yeah.
And so once I was brought in as a researcher to do the little film inserts for a program. Mm. And then I just had lots of ideas. And at one point, I decided, well, I wanted to make my own films. I didn't just want to, after about 2-3 years of making other people's ideas, I wanted to make my own. And so I thought, well, I need the time to come up with the ideas and sell them and pitch them.
Yeah.
So I needed a bit of income. So I started to drive a minicab.
Wow.
So there was a cab company called Lady Cabs. I was living in Hackney. And so I had to drive for like 3 or 4 days, nights, well, mainly nights actually.
Mm.
And they just took women and kids basically. So I would do that so that in the day I could, you know, work research my films, get the contributors on board. And then I managed to sell my first documentary to Channel 4, which was about paparazzi photographers. These two complete nutters were running around London. And it was great fun to do. I wanted to make a film about driving, actually, about being driving a cab. And the awful thing now is that, of course, the minute I get into an Uber or anything like that, I'm always going, you know, oh, but you could just go down that way. And, of course, they go, yes, but there's traffic there. I'm thinking, yeah, of course, when I was doing it, you know, we didn't have Waze or anything like that. It was the controller. It was like bloody taxi, you know, it was the controller. Yeah. It was a radio.
Yeah.
And that's how you did it.
That's amazing. So there's a question that I've been asking everyone in this season, and we spoke about it briefly. It's a really important message that I want to kind of cover. Talking to people about your dyslexia, so especially in your careers, school is one element of it, and people expect to hear the dyslexic in school, and your peers in school expect. But when you leave school and you go on to start your career, is there a right time, or when is the right time? And if the answer is probably actually never with the current stigma around dyslexia, what should we do about it? What's the idea? What in your mind would be a solution, or what you think we should do as a community to try and solve it?
Well, it's a really amazing question. And I'm really glad you've asked it. And in my role now, I work for BBC Studios as a talent executive.
Mm.
In drama and in scripted. So I'm in, you know, high-end TV drama, in our soaps, continuing drama series, in comedy. And we, as a business, are really passionate about bringing in diverse voices and making our workplace more diverse for all the reasons that we've talked about. It makes business sense, basically. And it also reflects people that are going to watch our shows, and it makes us make more, you know, better selling, better programs. So, you know, it's a, there's a many powerful reasons to do it. So certainly I think our business is changing. It's becoming much more aware internally, just as a culture, unconscious bias, all this stuff. But we also have specific targets, for want of a better word now, for representation within within the business. I mean, I've just, my brilliant boss and one of the heads of drama have just, they came up with the idea of having a scheme for neurodiverse talent because it's underrepresented and in post-production. So I've developed that, you know, with them. And it, we've just, our first trainee on Doctor Who in post-production is going to be starting, who's a neurodiverse talent. And that's incredibly exciting. So, you know, we're doing specific things like that. But in terms of self-declaring, I think it's such an interesting one because, look, here's me, been in television for decades, and I've only just gone public, if you like. So I get it, and I think it's a really personal thing to do. And as I said to you before, if I was starting out, I'd be maybe quite judicious about it. But increasingly, I'm having conversations every week now. With young talent who are self-declaring that they are disabled, but saying, or they have some kind of disability, but saying they're not sure whether to say it or not. Increasingly on CVs, people are putting it on. Say, I have a disability, it's this, that, or the other. And it's a really tricky one because I totally understand that people... And my son's very much like this as well, is that you don't want to be defined
by it.
You do not want to be defined by it. On the other hand, at some point, when do you put your hand up and go, this is who I am? Because if you don't, things are not going to change. And I think, again, it's back to things like Black Lives Matter. It's like people feel this, and me too. If you don't, if you don't stand up for who you are and what you believe in, then nothing's going to change. And I think it's a, it's quite a pivotal moment at now, actually, for all of that. I would never want to put any pressure on anybody. It's up to the individual how comfortable they feel about it. But in many ways, the more that people embrace it, the more rich and varied and diverse, and the level of understanding will go up.
Yeah.
In society, in the world, you know.
Well, this is the whole point, isn't it? We need to have conversations, and you can't have conversations without awareness. And how do you have awareness without the people who want to be heard talking? So I think there's a certain amount of steps. I think you're right. The reason why I asked the question is because there's no answer at the moment, because I keep on hoping everyone has the answer, but the truth is it is tricky at this stage, and there is a potential for being judged in a negative way for it. But yet, if no one wants to talk about it and put themselves out there, how do we ever move on if everyone ignores what's in front of you?
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think in television at the moment, it's perhaps quite particular, I don't know, compared to other businesses. But if you like, difference is actually at a premium now.
Mm.
And so, you know, I've said to my son, you know, suck it up. This is who you are.
Mm.
And he said, well, I don't want to be treated any differently. He doesn't work in TV, but it's I don't want to be treated any differently. I don't want to be given special treatment.
Mm.
And I said, no, the idea is that you are going to be put on a level playing field with everybody else. And if there's any adjustments, that will help you be the same as anybody else. So, you know, there is some leverage out there at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, if you are talent of a different ability, different background, we want to employ you. The art industry wants to employ you. So in a way, why not take advantage of it? You know, you've got enough disadvantage being neurodiverse as it is.
Mm. So for you, what would be a good, not solution's not the right word. What's a great way forward? I mean, you talk about a utopia. What would that in dyslexia be for you in either the working world or the school life? Because obviously there's some issues with your son, and you're one of hundreds of thousands of mums that went through this or are now going through this. What do you think we could do to try and improve that?
I just love to wave a magic wand and for no parent or kid to have to jump through all the hoops that people have to jump through. You know, we had to jump through, and people are still having to do it. Mm. I think it is an issue around funding. I think it's an issue around understanding. And to me as well, an acknowledgement of where specialist support, whether it's a unit that is within a mainstream school or college, or whether it's a specialist school environment.
Mm.
I think there should be an understanding that it's horses for courses, and not every kid who has a neuro disability can thrive in a mainstream school. You know, and if it's a unit, it needs to be a really good unit.
Yeah.
You know, and with staff with trained, you know, level five, level seven teachers who really know what they're doing.
Mm.
And also, as you said, you know, about the encouragement, and there needs a lot of the emotional side as well, of how to support kids who struggle for whatever reasons, because it is hard. And actually, you know, talked a lot before coming here about the invisible gift, you know, your title, which is brilliant. And I totally get it. And it is a 360 thing.
Mm.
And there's a lot of what we've been talking about today where, and listening to, you know, your other contributors as well, it's made me acknowledge and understand a bit more the aspects of what it probably has given me.
Mm.
Because to be honest, when I first thought about having this conversation with you, I was just thinking, well, I'm just going to have to be honest and say, it's not been an invisible gift. It's been a nightmare. And if you'd have asked me, would you rather be dyslexic or not dyslexic? I'd have said, absolutely not. It's been a total trial. It continues to be a trial. But I, on the other hand, I just get completely what you're saying. I think you're right. And I think this whole experience has made me understand and feel more, much more positive about it, because I can see what I have gained.
And I think a lot of the reason why we struggle with it, and you're right, I say it's an invisible gift, and I think it is, but I am not naive enough to believe that most people don't see it that way. And I think the way we can change that is, the reason why we feel crap about how we are is because we have stigma from society attached to it. So I think the way we can change that quite easily without completely changing the schooling system, because that is an animal in itself, and I haven't got the answer for that, and it will take a very great person to come up with a solution for that and a lot of time. But I think one thing we can do is make it less of a stigma at school. So when your peers leave school and they go on to these positions where they do have more kind of more sway in society, rather than looking at it as that's the person that got to spend more time on their test than I did, if we actually said to people, rather than these three people in our class are dyslexic, why don't we just go, these three people in the class are good at these skills and you're good at these skills. Again, collaboration. Same, it fits as collaboration for me, fits the same as diversity. If you learn to work together and realise just the strengths, because self-awareness on disabilities is great, and it's something that we need. Even if you're not neurodiverse, you still should know what you're good at and what you're not good at, and then collaborate. Then when they come into the working world, where they influence, because people at school now are going to be the rulers of the world, you know, if we learn that that is what you're used to and there's no negative connotations, then we can talk about it freely.
I think the stigma is so key. And it makes me feel quite emotional when you say that, to be honest with you, because stigma of any kind is not fun. And if you're someone who knows what that feels like, you're actually also very attuned to other communities and groups out there who feel the same way. You know, there's a kind of commonality there, because, you know, our experiences might be very different, but we sure as hell know what it's like to be stigmatized.
And I think deep down, everyone has something in their life that people have got stigma about.
Exactly. But I do think that there can be a more positive spin on it. It wasn't until I set foot in the specialist dyslexia school that I saw big posters on the wall of Eisenstein or, you know,
Richard Branson. Yeah.
And all these super successful people. Well, in any old primary school in the UK, you can have those pictures on the wall. And you can, when you're talking about people, you're talking about successful people, business, or as part of the curriculum, you can just pop that in.
Yeah.
You know, well, you know, they happen to be autistic. I mean, Elon Musk has just self-declared as being autistic. I mean, that is completely brilliant. But there's no reason why when kids are at school, they shouldn't know these things about very high achieving, successful people who've just done it in a different way.
See, it's funny because people like him publicly admitting it is a great step forward, because in everything in life, we always need someone who holds a lot of sway to pave the way for what we're doing. And it's and a lot rests on their shoulders. So you always kind of hold them up. And like you said, seeing people, when you see great people in front of you, it feels like you could just follow them. And that's kind of like what, that's my hope for the podcast and dyslexia generally and neurodiversity. Stop it.
You're doing a brilliant job. No, I think you're doing something really, really important, actually. I do.
Thank you very much. I think the thing is, I just didn't realise how big it was. And I think that's half the problem. We feel alone and we're not. And a lot of parents that have messaged me said they feel so alone, and things like Facebook groups and stuff like that really help them. But like any community that's just finding their feet, it's hard when you feel alone and you don't know what to do about it.
But I think also it's when you hear personal stories. I mean, I heard Justin Theroux, Louis Theroux's cousin, talking, and he had terrible problems at school. No one knew what was wrong. He was ADHD, as it turned out. And then, in fact, not until he was about 15 did they find out he was dyslexic.
Mm.
Well, he's gone on to write, you know, award-winning scripts.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, and that sort of makes you think, well, yeah, of course. It validates you. I think we all need validation, particularly when we've had challenges. And it's just so wonderful when you hear other people who are really good at what they do that are also dyslexic. You think, well, that's me.
I think I always think of a Michael McIntyre joke that always gets me when he said, it was about walking. He said, all parents worry about their kid walking. It's like their biggest worry. Now, I'm expecting my first child in September, so I haven't experienced it yet. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank
That's
you.
So exciting.
And, I know, scary. But he always says, parents worry about walking, and you've never gone to a party and someone's crawling on, oh, here's my husband, sorry, walking, never got used to it. Right? But it's, I think a lot of parents that listen worry that their children are going to go on and struggle in life. But I think once we embrace our strengths, our weaknesses can sometimes become not irrelevant, but second problems. Because let's face it, as a non-neurodiverse people have a lot of problems as well.
Completely.
And I think once you learn your lane and what you're good at, I think that comes out with everyone. Everyone feels that time where everyone knows when they've hit their career and they're in their lane and they know how to do it. And I think a lot of the time we overstress on it. And really, again, that's what I try and emphasize. It's definitely not a disability. It's just a difference, and difference is great. So thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Andrew. It's been a real revelation, actually, and a privilege. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let me jump in here, Andrew, before you say anything, and just comment on what a testament that last section by Carrie is, where she says the difference that the Invisible Gift podcast has made to her and her view of dyslexia, the lens through which she sees the challenge. So hats off to you for the work that you're doing, and the fact that she, as a big fan of the show, has come on and shared that, I think is so powerful.
Well, actually, since we've been doing podcasts, that's probably the most emotional I've ever got, because, you know, everyone wants to hear how they've made a difference, and hearing that from someone like her who deals with purpose-driven programs all the time, that's been her career, it was like, oh my God, that's too much. It's too nice.
Carrie, thank you so much for joining us. Absolute honour to have you on as a guest this week. I'm sure you echo that sentiment.
Yeah, and thank you for your kind words. You can't understand what that means to me.
Your comments on the destigmatization of dyslexia and putting a positive spin on neurodiversity, I think there are so many people listening that will take such positive from this episode. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll link some of Carrie's work in the show notes of this episode. You can find them where you listen to podcasts, or check out www.theinvisiblegift.com. If you'd like to write to us, share your thoughts, comments, feedback, questions for guests, or just generally interact with us, we'd love that. The email inbox is andrew@theinvisiblegift.com. Feel free to send us a voice note. You don't need to write. We can hear that stuff. Just whatever way is easiest for you to communicate, please do send it through. Andrew, I know it's really important to you.
Yeah, guys, it means everything to me to hear your thoughts and feedback and any stories you may have. And also, don't forget getting them social channels, because we've got some amazing content coming up this season, and it's real add-ons to what we're doing on the show.
When you say we've got some real guests, we've only got one more. Next week's the final week for this season.
No, it's gone too quickly, James.
I know. Next week, you are meeting with Sally Gardner, the author.
Oh, my God.
Now, I know this is a big one for you, because when we first ever met, you told me how you wanted to write a book. And she has written many a book. She's unbelievably gifted, an incredible storyteller. She's a great communicator. And I think it's going to be a great, powerful conversation. I think she's going to show you the art of storytelling.
Yeah, I can't wait. I've been listening to her books in preparation, and my God, is she talented.
So that's coming up next week, last one of the season.
Yeah, it's sad.
And then we won't be having these weekly get-togethers
anymore. No, what am I going to do?
We'll just have to hang out online or something. Cool, well, enjoy your conversation with Sally this week.
I can't wait.
And I'll see you back here for the final time this season.
See you next week. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast, presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.